This week, we welcome Shreyans Mehta, Chief Technology Officer at Sequence Security. In the Leadership and Communications segment, cybersecurity isn't just for tech people anymore. The weird approach to leadership, four things to do before a tough conversation, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. How much confidence do you have in your security program? Trusted Sec is a global information security consulting firm created by Dave Kennedy with some of the industry's most respected professionals. Their team works collaboratively with your company to improve security, regardless of its current maturity level. Trusted Sec offers an ever-growing list of customized services, including red and purple teaming, software and hardware security, incident response, PCI, and risk and maturity assessments. You can visit trustedsec.com/securityweekly to learn how TrustedSec can become an extension of your team.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 115, recorded January 31st, 2019. Yes, we are a few days late this week. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in G-Unit Studio in Rhode Island with my co-host, Paul Asadorian.
Hey, thanks, Matt. It's good to have you here in studio.
Yeah, that's why we delayed a little bit. It was so much easier to do these when we're together. So that's why we're late this week, everybody.
It's good. It's all good.
Very good. Join us April 1st to 3rd at Disney's Contemporary Resort for InfoSec World 2019. Visit infosecworld.misty.com/security-weekly and use the registration code OS19-SecWeek for 15% off the main conference or World Pass. We have a number of interviews scheduled with confirmed speakers across all of our shows, so please stay tuned to learn more about topics that will be covered at the conference. Also, we will be recording at InfoSec World 2019. If you're interested in booking an interview or a briefing with Security Weekly, please visit securityweekly.com/conference-request to learn more. Also, check out our on-demand material. Some of our previously recorded webcasts are now available on demand at securityweekly.com/on-demand. All right, let's start with our guest interview for this week. Shreyans Mehta is the co-founder and chief technology officer at Sequence Security. His innovation in network security have yielded many patents and solutions leveraging real-time packet inspection and cloud-based data analytics. If you want to learn more about Sequence Security, you can visit securityweekly.com/sequence. All right, Shreyans, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks, Matt.
So we want to talk a little bit about advanced bot protection. You guys have built some very interesting capabilities, and I think the problem statement is pretty straightforward, right? We see 30%+ of internet traffic being malicious kind of bot traffic, which kind of sets up the problem. Give us an idea of kind of how big that problem really is.
The way we see this is the world is changing around us. The 5 to 10 years ago, we used to have sort of a connected enterprise. But that has evolved into what we call it as a hyper-connected enterprise. Think about the applications that are out there. You have your mobile apps, you have your web applications, you have your APIs that are actually talking to these applications. Now, what we see in here is on a typical application, there are more than 20, 30 different entry points. And because of that, the attack surface to it has also increased. And that is what is leading to an escalating problem of bots that are coming in and trying to take things over.
And we've had approaches to this in the past of trying to protect against some of this bot traffic, but there are some challenges with some of those existing technologies, right?
That's right. So if you think about these bot attacks, what they're trying to do is sometimes they are trying to take over your account, sometimes they're trying to scrape, sometimes creating fake accounts leading to like fake news and fake likes. But there is nothing wrong sort of structurally with these requests. And what people are used to using is something like their CDNs to solve this problem, their web application firewalls, and sometimes even homegrown tools. But none of them can sort of detect the intent of these bots, because all they can do is some basic signature matching, like the CDNs. They don't even have the application context to understand what these bots are doing. All they can do is, okay, how fast are things coming in? Maybe I'll statistically detect that and block these things. The web application firewalls that you have in today, they can just do basic signature matching and they add latency because everything is in line. And then the people are also sort of getting introduced to what we call as the first generation bot defense solutions. But they are very hard to integrate. And you have to change your application to make things work in those environments.
Right.
So, Shrans, when I go to websites, right, especially ones that require a login or some kind of registration, there's that little checkbox that I have to click that says I'm not a robot, right? I think that's kind of like the evil bit that we joked about in packets, right? Like, oh, I'm not a robot. But like, how does that work, and what are some of the limitations of that solution compared to some of your more innovative techniques?
Sure. So I think that's a very good basic check, I would say. What it does is it runs some sort of a JavaScript on your web page and tries to detect is if I can run the JavaScript, it collects some basic things around that do it, did I move the mouse or not, and then sends that information back to the website and says that, okay, this it looks like a real browser and it must be a human driving it. But the problem with that approach is, number one, is it sometimes comes with what we call as CAPTCHAs. What that means is it causes people to read up some things that they're not used to reading because it looks very scribbled up and things like that. The second thing is, effectively, you have to change your website code to make these things work. Mm-hmm. It works well if you have like a one or two applications, but for applications that are hundreds of them, like in certain large organizations, it's very hard to keep up with instrumenting those things. The second problem with this approach is it doesn't really work on mobile applications. That mobile applications work on XML and JSON. And there is really no way to put JavaScript in there. And again, if you extend that thing for sort of a enterprise to enterprise communication that is exposed through APIs, mm-hmm. really not an option there as well. So it's a very limited approach, and it causes sort of a lot of pain in your sort of engineering process to instrument these applications for captures and JavaScript to run.
I feel like also from the attacker's perspective that it could be pretty easily bypassed, right? I mean, you could outsource your CAPTCHA fill-ins to actual human beings somewhere. You could either block JavaScript or render JavaScript depending on what your goal is as an attacker, correct?
That's right. So again, my background is I come from Symantec, and I've seen these kinds of instrumentations and sort of reversing of JavaScripts in the past. Mm. And it's what we see is effectively all these kinds of sort of JavaScript-based detection mechanisms are prone to sort of what we call as a replay attacks, where you can capture what kind of data these JavaScripts are sending back to the application, and then sort of replay it over a period of time. Obviously, you can include some fuzziness mm-hmm. so that it's not the same static content going over and over again.
Matt? So if you have, so if the current techniques, the CAPTCHAs, the WAFs, the CDNs don't work. What's a better way to solve part of this challenge? How do you do it differently then?
So number one is, I mean, if to include any security, right, you have to make it very, very simple to integrate. So we the way to deal with it is it should be non-intrusive in nature. Otherwise, people tend to either disable it or only put locks on certain doors and not protect your entire ecosystem. So the right way to actually do this is it should be able to discover all the applications that you have in your environment, because your DevOps folks are rolling out new applications. Sometimes you're acquiring new companies and you're sort of onboarding maybe 10, 15, hundreds of new applications. So first thing is to get visibility into what your attack surface is like, rather than, okay, I know this application is being attacked, I need to start instrumenting it. So that is a big part of detecting bots. The second part is, without adding any risk to the application, we should be able to detect, are they being abused or not, right? In terms of a human or a machine coming in, and what is the intent of that bot that is coming in? Because you just don't want to simply stop at, oh, this is an automation, and I want to go ahead and stop it. Because there is tons of good automation hitting your site as well, and you don't want to block those guys. So that's the second big aspect when it comes to detecting bots properly. And the third aspect is you should be able to defend in a way using your own tools, or because without adding new risk by putting anything in line or sort of instrumenting new applications, but you should be able to defend them in a way that is sort of adds less risk to your setup.
So can't be in line, because that's what the WAFs do and creates some of the latency.
Can't be a proxy either.
I don't think it can be a proxy.
That's in line. Yeah, I mean, proxy, right? Is basically an inline method.
I don't think you want it to be agent-based or anything along those lines. So is it purely network detection kind of techniques then that you use to help do aspects of that discovery and analysis to really identify that traffic and to understand whether it's good or bad? Is it all kind of at the network layers where you're primarily doing this?
That's right. So basically what we do is we take the copy of the traffic so that there is no risk added to the system. And also, because it's not about that single transaction that is coming in, it's about similar transactions that come in, right? So you need the ability to sort of cluster together similar transactions. And the way we do this is we take metadata from this network traffic, ranging from the network layer, going to the HTTP layer, going up to the application layer, even going to the user layer, and trying to detect anomalies in their behaviors. Effectively, it's like a system that brings together three different vectors: the tool or the browser behavior, the network behavior, and the user behavior, and then try to detect if there is some sort of a anomaly in terms of is it behaving like a real human being, or is it behaving anomalously? And then you can bring in intent detection on top of it.
Right. So that correlation point of those different layers coming together, look at kind of known good behavior, identifying potential malicious behavior, there's your detection mechanism. Then then the question is, okay, so I see something that looks malicious. What's the remediation step? What's that action that you can take to then protect your site or that API from that traffic? What does that look like then?
Yeah, so again, the way the traditional systems work is they believe in simple blocking. And what we see, especially in these kinds of bot attacks, is if you go ahead and block these kinds of bots, they either move on and come back from a different IP address, or they try to retool, because there are millions of IP addresses that are available out there, and blocking is not the right approach to solve it. Instead, the approach that we believe in is what we call as honey trap, where we can actually confuse the attackers by sending them fake responses. So think about it, let's say I have a billion credentials or username passwords that I'm actually trying out. And my job using a tool, like either a scripted tool or using Sentry MBA or Sniper or whatever that might be, is to see out of those billion credentials, how many credentials that actually work. I'm not actually manually checking each one of them to see. So what happens is if we detect this kind of an activity, we can send back fake responses. Okay, let the tool think that there are credentials that are coming in, maybe one out of 1,000, and they are actually working on the site. But in actuality, there's nothing that is going past us. We are sort of taking care of it and confusing the attack tool. Same can go in with new account creation. So even sort of like or sort of a reputation kind of systems. So this can be integrated into every flow, and that way you significantly slow down the attacker. And that's what we think is the right approach to solve this problem.
So if they can't get a valid response, they're not testing out whether that attack technique in that particular case is working, and therefore it helps protect the site because you're kind of throwing them off. So that's it's kind of a little bit of a deception play, but it's actually helping to mitigate some of that traffic in being successful in getting through.
That's right. And then there are other techniques as well that work come here, right? So rather than sort of being a black box, we believe in sort of a platform strategy where we sort of make our customers aware of what's actually happening. So you get visibility into what kind of attacks are coming in, what are kind of credentials are being tried out. And then at that point, you can even potentially connect into other systems that you might have, right? So you might have a fraud system upstream and you want to combine the signals that we might have with their signals to get a sort of a 1+1=3 effect. You want to push signals from our system into your existing inline system that you might have. So the CQ Connect capability in our platform allows you to get better value, not just with our product, but with the ecosystem of products that you might have deployed in your environment.
Right. So if I see this malicious behavior going on, I know it's malicious, I can actually potentially integrate back into my web app firewall to create some rules to actually do some blocking and making that more effective in the overall kind of ecosystem solution then.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
That's great. So what's some of the value out of leveraging this type of approach? I mean, a lot of organizations have already spent good money on their CDNs and their web app firewalls. Where's the value of implementing some of these advanced bot protection capabilities for the organization? Where's that value prop?
So what we're seeing is, given that this is sort of an escalating problem, it's because ultimately these kinds of attacks either lead to fraud or sometimes even loss of business. Think about different use cases. Somebody is doing account verification, username, password checking, and ultimately it's going to take over account and then commit fraud using that. Sometimes what we see is because the websites in certain cases see 90 to 95% of their actual traffic coming in from these bots, it causes unavailability of applications. The applications just can't scale up to that level. So what we're seeing is the value really comes in from the reduction in fraud, sort of your infrastructure running healthy. And sometimes you don't want to actually put your customers through the second factor authentication process, because at a certain point you might even lose them because they can't solve these captures. So all these things actually come together if you properly defend your web properties from these bot attacks.
Right. And you don't necessarily have to replace some of your existing tools if you allow those integrations to happen. You may actually help some of those tools, I guess, perform a little better because it's the combination of these techniques and capabilities that provide a better protection mechanism.
That's right. So most security teams, they like efficiency, right? And what we see is if you just have a sort of a black box approach and they don't get visibility into what's actually happening, or combine those signals with the other systems that you have, it's really hard for them to manage these systems. and you get operational efficiency by combining the six systems and integrating with into other systems as well.
Right. A really holistic approach to solving the problem. Paul, any other questions?
Yeah. What's your advice for our CISO and executive audience? If you could like distill it down for them as to the benefits of having this technology when they go, you know, report to their board and discuss the business side of things, you know, how does it help?
So the real value prop of putting Sequence into any environment is it's very easy to integrate and there is a real ROI. So it improves the operational efficiency of their sort of security team by taking care of bot attacks that cause fraud or unavailability of applications in their environment. And then there is a real ROI to it. So effectively, it's more like a painkiller rather than a vitamin. So it's you can actually see the value the moment you actually deploy it in your environment.
Yeah, I feel like it lets you focus on what's important. As a security analyst or engineer, there's like this whole swath of traffic that like I don't need to worry about. It's not hitting any of my security tools, my monitoring tools, my network sniff, whatever it is. It allows me as the analyst to focus on what's important. That's just one of the values of it. I like that.
That's right. Yep.
Oh, very good. Shreyans, thank you for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me there. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, if anyone wants to learn more about Sequence Security's advanced bot protection, please visit securityweekly.com/sequence. Sequence is spelled with a C, not an S. We'll take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
The modern attack surface is vast and permeable, extending from the data center to the cloud and device edge. Security teams are stretched thinner and thinner as they try to cover this ground. The result? More high-profile breaches hit the news every day. Don't let your organization be next. ExtraHop delivers security from the inside out, helping enterprise security teams detect threats up to 95% faster and cut staff time to resolve by 2/3 or more. Act with confidence. Learn more at extrahop.com/securityweekly. Effectively securing your organization and its reputation requires a smarter approach. To maximize efficiency and minimize risk, security experts turn to LogRhythm, the only leading solution built solely for security teams by a security team committed to your success. With next-gen SIEM, user and entity behavior analytics, network traffic and behavior analysis, security automation and orchestration, and compliance, LogRhythm provides security made smarter.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian. RSA Conference 2019 is the place to be from March 4th to 8th. San Francisco will come alive with cybersecurity's brightest minds as they gather together to discuss the industry's newest developments. Go to rsaconference.com/securityweekly-US19 to register now using the discount code 5U9SWFD to receive $100 off your conference pass. Security Weekly will be in Broadcast Alley on Monday and Tuesday of RSA Conference, recording sponsored interviews and hosting briefings. To learn more or request time with us, please visit securityweekly.com/conference request. We already have a number of requests already coming in. As we sent out an email earlier this week, and obviously a lot of people want to talk to us when we're there. So,
well, yeah, and I guess we should mention that all of the briefings requests for free briefings are at our discretion.
Yeah, we go through. Yeah, we've gotten a bunch of,
because we can't do every.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't do every single briefing. Mm-hmm. But
I'd like to, believe me. Yeah, but it's only
we only have so many slots in that 2 days. We're in Broadcast Alley, but we've got a lot of requests for briefings. I know we've got a number of sponsored interviews already scheduled. So people who have submitted patients with us, we'll go through that list and kind of finalize that as we get closer to the conference and get those booked.
Sweet.
Yeah. So let's get into our articles for this week. I even had a couple extra days, but we said this yesterday on ESW. Mm-hmm. News is kind of slow in some respects. You know, I see a lot of repeat articles, so I try to weed those out. And even with the extra couple of days, I'm like, man, it's hard finding some really good quality articles.
Sometimes we've gone, you know, the past 14 years, some weeks are better than others when it comes to news. I mean, we're really at the mercy of reporting the news. Like, right. It's whatever's being reported at that time.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And for some reason, we're just kind of slow part of the year for us. But this first article is cybersecurity isn't just for tech people anymore. It's an article from MIT, the Sloan School at MIT. And what they're promoting really here is a new executive education course, cybersecurity leadership for non-technical executives. And really what the article is starting to talk about is cybersecurity is responsibility of everybody. It's not just the tech people anymore. It's really anybody. And if you're an executive in your organization, you don't have a lot of technical background, they've got a course here to help you kind of learn some of the basics. But they also give some interesting tips on, you know, how to deal with some of that non-technical staff and try to make cybersecurity more of a kind of cultural fabric in the organization, which I think is something that's important because, look, users click on the link and that's how a lot of breaches happen.
Well, I mean, look, it's complicated, right? I mean, before we had the internet, running a business or law enforcement or government or whatever was not as complicated, right? We had security issues, right? But they were easier.
It was usually physical security issues, though.
It was mostly physical security, computer security. A lot of if you go way back, they weren't connected.
They weren't
to each other.
No.
You know, they were. Even if they were, there wasn't as many people on the internet. People that were doing bad things, even in the early days, I don't think it was as much of a profit and revenue generation motivation, right? And slowly, it started creeping into organized crime. It started creeping into other countries, you know, China, Eastern Bloc countries, for a lot of social and economic reasons, right, where we landed today. But I feel like way back when, it's not as much of a concern. So now we've got to play a lot of catch-up where we're at today with security. And I think where this really was exemplified for me, it could be an enterprise play because, yes, some of your physical security, as you said, Matt, does now tie into cybersecurity. In fact, most of it pretty much does. You know, when there's a crime that happens anywhere in the world today, there's now new data that law enforcement can look at. And I think federal law enforcement has been a little more ahead of the curve in this aspect. Local law enforcement is catching up. They have made some huge strides. I think we still got a lot of work to do, but it is catching up. In other words, if there's a crime committed, well, is there a Wi-Fi router around? Was that person's phone automatically associating the Wi-Fi router? Can that now give me evidence to say that a person was in a specific physical location where a crime occurred, in addition to pulling camera footage? So, I mean, overall, in law enforcement, as an example, you got to be more technical. And I think it really ties back to your article. It's not just for tech people.
It's not.
It's for law enforcement. Yeah. It's for executives. It's for people.
It's for anybody.
Working in a manufacturing floor, whatever the case may be.
It's right? For my wife who, look, as we've gone through the digital transformation, mm-hmm. we are so connected.
Yes.
With everything. Everything we use on our phone is an app.
The first time I heard this quote was like episode 3 or 4 of Paul Security Weekly. And it was Mike Poore. It said, today, you're only a few milliseconds away from every attacker in the world on the internet. And that was even 13, 14 years ago when Mike said that. And I think it might have been, recycled by Dan Gere and maybe some others. And now today,
it's the corollary.
There's so many more attackers right. now. And so many more people connected.
And they're milliseconds away from billions of people on the internet every single day mm-hmm. interacting with their bank accounts and their social media accounts and mm-hmm. all the other things that are going on. And so this article does, you know, I think this was like a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. But I think executives have to understand that this is pervasive across their entire employee base. This is not just about the security team. This mm-hmm. is really about all the employees. How do we help raise the level of understanding from a security perspective of what is going on out there? And you know, this course is supposed to help. But
criminals are going to latch on to the technology at their own pace, right? And by necessity, as older methods of crime essentially aren't as effective and don't scale as much. I don't know if you ever remember watching the Sopranos. Did you ever watch the Sopranos?
Yeah.
There was one episode of the Sopranos where Chris, his nephew, was involved in this phone card scam, right? And it was like a new thing. And like Tony and the older guys were like, oh, it's making money. Like that's cool, right? But it was some, and I wish I could remember the details. I got to go back and watch it because it's a good example of how criminals will latch on to, back then, a phone calling card was an important piece of technology in a sense, and they had some scam that they were, you know, illegitimately making money off of that. And, you know, then, like, phone cards aren't really a thing anymore, so now you got to move on to the next thing, and that's and that's the internet.
Well, because we don't have pay phones anymore because everybody's walking around with one in their pocket, so what do you need phone cards for anymore? Yeah, exactly, right. Number two, this one was a little surprising. Boardrooms are still not singing the security song. And it's a survey, and I don't normally like to pull
in.
Is
there a security song? Is there like an actual song?
I don't know.
It's not an actual song.
I don't think there's an actual song.
That's a euphemism.
Kumbaya, maybe. I don't know. But I don't normally pull some of these surveys, but I thought it was interesting data in that despite security top of mind, less than 50% of companies have a CISO position with a seat at the board, which, you know, you would think with all the attacks, all the breaches, the onus, you know, even some of the articles we covered a couple weeks ago, you know, for the CEO, cybersecurity is top of mind. But yet the CISO doesn't have a seat at the board. So security's still not always at that same level with other executives in the organization, even though people have security top of mind. It is an important component. We're still seeing less than 50% board participation. I just think that's an interesting statistic. I know a lot of our listeners in the CISO audience that we talk to, a lot of them do have that seat at the board, but there's still a number of them that don't. And, you know, I still find that a little surprising based on where we are, but there's some numbers, which is why I pulled this one in.
Yeah, I thought we were further along.
I thought
and
so
I guess because we talk to CISOs that may be more involved in it's just kind of our view of the world, and maybe we speak with CISOs and other business folks who are working for organizations that are more forward thinking when it comes to security. But you got to step back and take that holistic approach.
You got to look at everybody.
And this was a good kind of level set to
exactly where we're at. And one of the things that it mentions in here is the stigma of security being the guys that always say no. And we've talked about this many times. Security folks have to work closely with the business, and it's not always about saying, no, you can't do that. It's about how do we enable it and reduce risk and secure aspects of it so that we can get to a yes. And I think that's one of the points they point out here in this article, is that stigma of security always being the group that says no might be one of the reasons why they're not at the board level in all these organizations. My next article is The Weird Approach to Leadership. It's Charles Towers Clark, author of The Weird CEO, talks about his approach, some of the different ways of how to drive leadership. And, I don't necessarily agree with all the things that are in here. It was an interesting way to think about leadership differently. There's a couple really good points in here. There's a couple things that may not work for everybody, but one of the things he said is, look, empower decisions down to your executive team. Let them make the decisions on a lot of the buying and purchasing decisions. Enable the executive team. Don't make it a dictatorship, which I agree with. The more we can distribute that down to people, I think the better. And allow those executives in the organization to take more of a leadership decision-making role. But so I totally agree with that. And that's kind of how we work, and that's how we've worked at a lot of the companies we've worked with in the past. The one I didn't agree with was take responsibility for your salary and budget, where he even recommends here, employees get to set their own salaries, and they get to decide what their budgets are. I don't know that I would go that far. I'm not quite sure that's the right answer either, because everybody's going to want to put their like salaries at the highest.
A little extreme. I agree with you, Matt. I think that it needs to be a discussion. You need to work together as a team. on many different all aspects of the business, including salary and budget.
Yeah.
I think that's
the budget part I agree with. I'm not quite sure about the salary side. I think that gets a little tricky in a larger organization where employees kind of get to set their own salaries. And then he said, make them all transparent so everybody knows what everybody's making. Yeah. I'm not sure.
I'm not convinced of that.
I'm not convinced on that one. So that's the one point out of this article I didn't quite agree with. Budgets, though, I think so. If you're in a leadership position, you're given the budgeting side, you ought to be able to make the decisions and how to drive that budget and measure against that. It's something, you know, I'm very transparent here, you know, kind of our budget, our plan. I think it's good for people to know where you are. I'm just not sure everybody having salaries posted on transparently is a good idea.
Yeah, I agree.
Next one, four things to do before a tough conversation. We've all had tough conversations at some point. And this article talks specifically about getting ready to fire a person and how he prepares for the conversation, those things that he wants to prepare for is part of having that conversation. And no, the first thing he says is, look, get your motives right. Why are you doing this? Make sure you have the right motives for why you're taking the action you're going to have.
Right.
And just make sure you're comfortable with it. I think that's a really important part, right? You have to know what you're doing, what the motive behind it is.
Yeah. And I think that ties into one of his other points of, you know, get your emotions in check.
Correct. Yeah. Get your emotions.
You're going to have emotions. Sometimes I like to let those play out in private, right? You run through the scenarios, get your emotions out of the way. You put those to the side, then you get back to your motives, right? So I think his order is just maybe a little off.
Right.
Get back to your motives. Why are you making this? Is it for what benefit? Right.
Yeah. And
oftentimes it's just not the right fit.
Yeah, it's not. But I think he's also saying on the emotion side is, okay, once you know the motive of why you're doing this, get yourself emotionally ready because there's gonna be emotions on the other side. And you got to be prepared for those and not caught off guard when you're having that tough conversation in order to do that. So that's very important. Gather the facts, obvious. You know, when you're making these decisions, make sure you know what your facts are, right? And why you're doing this. It kind of ties into that whole motive piece. And then what I thought was interesting was get curious, right? You need to be confident because you have your motive, you have your facts, you got your emotions under control. But then he talks about curiosity and how that can actually offset this. And I wasn't quite sure how this piece played in because I think if you go in with this concept of being curious or curiosity, you potentially open a can of worms that puts you in a really difficult position in that conversation. I'm not sure that...
I would pull this one out.
Yeah, I would too because I'm
I like his last one. Which I think kind of supersedes the curiosity is get your facts straight.
Right, get your facts straight. And so, that curiosity piece, I'm like, you can open up a dialogue that gets you in a weird spot. And I didn't agree
with that. But I think in any situation when we talk about having the facts, it's hugely valuable. Any tough interaction where there's emotions at stake, where maybe there's a mistake, maybe there's an unfortunate situation, whatever the case may be, you got to have all your facts, right? Like, what went wrong? Why did it go wrong? Clearly spell that out and have all the facts. Don't leave anything to imagination and spell out the facts. I think that's something I learned over the course of my 25-year career is you got to have the facts. And, I mean, you've seen that firsthand here. You know, if there's someone that's, you know, things happen. Right. When you're running a business, when you're running a team, could be a sports team, could be a business, could be a family, like shit happens. And troubleshooting, like just having all the facts is after you set your emotions aside, you got to have all of those indicators and facts and to process that, I think is, especially for a tough decision.
Yeah.
Super important.
Super important.
What happened? Why did it happen? And having all of those facts correct. Super important.
Agreed. We have lots of facts.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. These last three articles all kind of tie together. And we've talked about aspects of this already, but I kind of pulled it from a technology through the challenges, through maybe some solutions. And it comes, a lot of articles on artificial intelligence. It's just been one of those topics this year. I just, holy cow. We get a ton, every week I see a ton of these, right? So the first article is more firms will integrate AI into the workplace. This is an extension of the Gartner article we covered a week or two ago. I think I did it by myself when you were out last week. You know, it's extension of the virtual private assistants, but it's other AI techniques that are coming into the office place, into the workplace. And we're going to see this, right? We're going to see artificial intelligence being integrated into our tools and our processes to help streamline activities. We're going through the same process ourselves internally with a lot of our operational processes and streamlining. Artificial intelligence is going to kind of be that next evolution of how these things fit together. So that's, you know, that's Gartner's, hey, by 2021, 70% will be using, you know, aspects of artificial intelligence in the workplace. Okay, cool. The second article then ties into IT leaders grapple with workforce skill gaps as they deploy AI and digital technology. So with all new technologies that start to get integrated into workplaces, now people are struggling to find workforce skill, people with the skills to help deploy these new technologies, whether it's artificial intelligence or digital technology as part of this digital transformation. This is where IT leaders are continuing to struggle. And we've talked about this from a career perspective. You know, look, there are some really hot areas for workforce skills. AI, digital technology, cybersecurity, cloud, these are all really hot areas. So as people are looking to advance or move in their career, these are some of the areas people are really looking for resources and need the help out there. So I thought that was a nice tie-in to the first one.
Absolutely.
And then my last one for the day is recruiting data scientists for AI and machine learning. So this talks about the recruiting side of trying to find those people. And here they really talk more about recruiters. We had a really good recruiter at Tenable. Remember Sean?
Sean's awesome.
Right. He was fantastic. We had a really good team, and that recruiter really helped us go identify talent as we were bringing it into Tenable. And the recommendation here is, look, go out and get yourself a really good recruiter.
What I liked about Sean, one thing I liked about Sean, I mean, I like him as a person, but he was very engaged with everyone. He was engaged with everyone at Tenable. He was engaged with everyone in the security community. He was engaged with all of the people applying or thinking about applying. He was a very engaged recruiter, and I think that's one of the key factors to his success.
And that's why they want you to have a recruiter, because they're going to build confidence with the recruit. They're going to build those connections into the industry, and it'll make them more connected to find those quality resources that you want to bring in into your environment. Obviously, it talks about some diversification here, but there was a really good point down here about respect and really having respect for the talent. Again, in this space, highly specialized, probably pretty technical, and you have to build a level of respect during that interview process. You need to treat them really well, because let's assume they come over, but they don't feel respected or they don't feel like they fit in. Guess what? They're going to leave. And when they leave, now you've got to go out
again
and go through the whole process again. Good talent's hard to find, but good talent is also hard to keep if you're not giving them that really good environment to stay.
You know, in soapbox moment here, for bear with me, but I think that when we say that there's a skills shortage for cybersecurity, I think that's grossly overstated. I think that we do a very poor job inside organizations defining the requirements for the roles that we have. I think sometimes we feel like it's really technical and specialized, when if we took a step back, there's probably a lot more candidates for that job that have the right characteristics, which aren't necessarily skills, and we do way too much hiring of skills than for characteristics, personality, and a good fit outside of those skills.
But the other thing I think we do a bad job of is we put requirements in there that may not be actual requirements. You must have a bachelor's degree.
Why?
Some of the smartest people I know didn't finish their degree.
Okay? Or they have a degree in something
or
not.
Or in something else that's
which
not
is
related.
A, which is a good perspective
which
to have.
Is okay.
It's good to have diversification on your team in a lot of different aspects. All kinds of diversifying, male, female, all backgrounds, races, religions, right? That's
right.
Important. Also, people with different degrees, that's a good diversification to have. But also, the main thing I think is to hire for the character of that person
yes.
and the right fit for the organization.
Yeah.
Skills
they,
can always be learned. That's one of the characteristics that we look for that I think more organizations should look for is that person motivated to build their skills in the right direction? Do they have maybe some related skills and they're a good fit?
And they have a good background?
I'll hire that person all day long over the person who has 5 years experience with that specific skill set. And as we know in business today, there's a lot of things that could throw that out the window. Maybe we change gears and we use a different technology, right? That's one reason why you want to be hiring the right people based on character.
Yeah, and I don't think a degree is a requirement necessarily to fill a position. And I think too many organizations make that a requirement and you limit a pool of talent that could easily fit that job description, but because they don't have the degree, you throw them out. And I don't think that's right either.
Educational institutions will require a degree. And in some of, part of me, I can see that, right? Like you're working for an institution that is providing degrees for other people. And when you come into certain roles in that organization, they like you to have a degree to be a representative. And I don't agree with it entirely, but I can see their point. Having said that, having worked at a university, I think one of the reasons I was hired there was not because of the experience I had with my degree, but when they started asking questions about my home lab and my experience, I was like, yeah, I have that set up in my home lab. That showed I had motivation with the right skill set, which to them was more important than a degree. Educational institutions will put that requirement in there, but I think, again, more important is motivation.
Yeah. And nobody goes back and looks to see what my degrees are anymore.
Yeah.
I'm way past that at my age.
Yeah,
now,
I think initially it's one
of
those
things. It's an initial thing.
It's like certifications and degrees are similar in that
exactly.
respect. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe some certifications are required, but maybe not all of them are. I mean, I still maintain my CISSP. Do I use my CISSP on a daily basis? Folks, the answer is no.
Yeah.
Not anymore. I mean, it gives me a good background for all the different disciplines in security. I maintain that certification, but I don't need that to do my job today.
It's more of a data point for me than a requirement, right? If someone did get a degree, it shows they can commit to something and finish. I think it's the same thing with a certification.
Yeah.
They can show commitment and that they achieve something that they believed was beneficial to their career. I respect that. And it's a plus in my...
Yes.
Is it a requirement in all jobs? No.
No, I don't think so. Mm. All right, folks, that's our articles for this week. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.